This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 14 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I get really anxious when I approach and do things that I've never done before. It's not that I'm not willing to try new things. I try new things all the time. I just like to be prepared. I like to know what's going to happen before it happens. So I'll research and research and research and research something before I experience that something. A good example happened this past weekend. My childhood best friend is getting married in late June, and I was tasked to come up with something to do in the Pittsburgh area for his bachelor party with 20 to 30 people during the day before we all went on a party bus later that night. Let me tell you, it's tough to find something to do with 20 to 30 people, especially if that's something doesn't involve adult beverages. But I found Big City Hunts. It's this website online. It's a company that makes mobile scavenger hunts. You split up into teams, you go around the city, and there are a lot of cities that it supports, and you go around the city and you answer questions and you get clues, and it's a good time. It's a scavenger hunt. For like a month though, before we did this hunt this past weekend, I was researching like a madman. I didn't want this thing to be screwy. I didn't want to screw it up for everyone. Not my buddy, not the people I was with. I didn't want to disappoint 20 plus people. That's awful. That's a terrible feeling. I watched YouTube videos that people created on their big city hunt. I creepily watched strangers experience scavenger hunts in random cities like Columbus, Ohio. But by the time the scavenger hunt rolled around, sure, I was a little nervous that someone's phone wouldn't work or things wouldn't go right. But when the last weekend finally rolled around, I was pretty prepared. I felt pretty good about what was about to happen. I felt like I wasn't going to disappoint people. I mean, there are some things that I definitely have a DGAF attitude about and that I don't explore before diving in. Like, I'm never the guy who looks at restaurant menus before going to a restaurant, let's say. I don't get anxious or nervous before playing a round of golf or doing a fantasy football draft because I do those things all the time. It's new experiences where I, and I'm sure a lot of you guys fall into this category too, where I just kind of get anxious. And the way to not be anxious is preparation and knowing what you're getting into. What's that quote? Success is where preparation and opportunity meet. I wanted a successful scavenger hunt, you guys. I wanted it to be successful. This outlook I have with preparation and research is similar to how I approach my work. This podcast, for instance, and I know it sounds crazy, but I'm actually not simply just hitting record and saying things. I actually make notes. I want to talk about things that are interesting. I want you guys who listen to this podcast to walk away with something that you learned. And the same goes with my analysis. I try really, really hard to always absorb as much information as I can from all sorts of places to try to be the most well-rounded analyst I can be. I work hard and prepare, or I at least try to. I know it sounds lame, but it's just the truth. It's how I am. I don't want to be the person who does just sit down and hit record because I don't think that you guys are going to get enough out of that person. When I started at NumberFire almost 4 years ago, when I got this full-time job that I've somehow kept for almost 4 years, I had to approach things this way. I was entering a new job, and you know you always want to be prepared when that's the case. But I was entering a new job, and within that job, I was forced in a way to learn about things about the sport that got me that job in the first place. I was forced to learn new things about football. Because at NumberFire, there's a metric that we use all over the place and was used all over the place when I joined called net expected points. And remember, this was 2013. Expected points models weren't as popular as they might be now, though I'd argue they're still not popular enough. I had experience in viewing them and looking at what the models were saying, but I never dug deep into them. Until I got to NumberFire, I had to dig deep. I also wanted to be good at using the metric because I wanted to be good at my job and I wanted to show people that I was good at my job. So I learned all I could about our expected points model, why it's important, how we use it, and so on. So I could probably do a podcast by myself and explain net expected points to a level that would be fine. But I actually thought it would be best to bring on the person who created the metric for us to use at NumberFire. Keith Goldner is our chief analyst, and he's the brainiac behind the proprietary metrics you see on our site. He made our net expected points metric, or NEP for short. He developed our nerd ratings, which you can view on the Sports Power Rankings pages throughout our entire website. Keith is our math whiz. He joined me to talk about our net expected points metric and NumberFire's win probability model, giving tips on how you can use our numbers to better yourself as a fantasy football owner. Give it a listen. So Keith, I mentioned net expected points, or NEP as we call it over at NumberFire, on the podcast all the time, but only give a brief introduction to the metric rather than diving super deep into it. So can you, the creator of the metric at NumberFire, explain what NEP is all about?
Sure. Yeah, the whole point of NEP is that football is extremely situational and you want to be able to compare different situations equally. So what I always say is all yards are not created equal, and the best way to kind of explain it is to look at an example. So if you have running back A, it's 3rd and 15, he runs for 10 yards, then it's going to be 4th and 5, the team's either going to punt or kick a field goal depending on where they are on the field. Not that great, but in the box score, 10 yards and 10 yards per carry looks really good. Then you compare that to running back B, who runs for 2 yards on 3rd and 1, he converts to a new set of downs, increases his team's chances of scoring. They get the first down, but in the box score, you only see 2 yards. So when you compare the two, traditionally, the first guy, both on yards per carry and on total yards, looks 5 times better than the second. And what net expected points really does is it puts all situations on an even playing field and compares the performance there against league average. So we look at every single down, distance to go, and yard line, and we look historically, how many points on average has a team scored there? How many expected points does that team have? So a 1st and 10 on your own 20-yard line might be worth something like 1 point after a kickoff, that kind of thing. And then as you move down the field, and your expected points should increase unless you get into long 3rd down situations or 4th down situations where you're expected to punt. And that way you can compare a 1st and 10 from your own 20 to a 4th and goal from the 1-yard line because you have a standard base metric to compare it against. And what net expected points is essentially is just looking at the difference between two plays and to see if you've increased your team's chances of scoring or decreased your team's chances of scoring.
And so with that too, whoever that player is, like let's say it's Le'Veon Bell making that run that's converting that 3rd down, those individual instances are then being credited to Le'Veon Bell. And then the reason that net is there is because you're adding all of those instances up, correct?
So the net is actually the difference between the previous play and the current play to see how much you increased or decreased your team's chances of scoring. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, you're summing that up throughout the entire game for each individual player and their contributions in those plays as much as we can distribute credit.
So net expected points, I mean, this is a very real football metric. We're dealing with what's actually happening on the football field, and the points that are being attributed to these players are real points. They're not fantasy points. So how do you take this metric and then leverage it to create projections for fantasy football?
Yeah, so what we're really trying to do is get a better understanding of the players and teams in the game. And in order to create projections, there's always the old moniker, which is garbage in, garbage out. So if you're putting in bad information into a model, what you get out is going to be bad. So in order to get a better understanding of the players and teams, we use this metric that's going to be more, it has a higher ability to project because we understand when players have actually done something well versus when maybe the defense has let them run for 10 yards on 3rd and 15 because they still got their job done. And this way you have the better understanding of the teams and players going into the model, and you're going to have better results coming out because we can, in our instance, we use similarity scoring so we can really see how efficient players were and compare them historically to similar players.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that one thing too with net expected points is you're looking at situations like a guy converting on 3rd down and or a guy who's converting in these high leverage situations that will improve their expected points total a lot more than a guy, like you said earlier, who's making creating a 10-yard run on a play that doesn't really matter. It's not converting or extending the drive. So have you found that players who are just better at net expected points or within the net expected points metric, because they are making these plays in higher leverage situations, have you found that they are just in turn better players and they're seeing the field more and so on? Is there some correlation there?
Yeah, there definitely is. One thing to think about in football more than any other sport is kind of the game theory aspect of it, which is that like one thing we actually see a lot is that backup running backs tend to have a pretty high efficiency and net expected points. And that's because when they come in the game, the defense expects the team to be passing as they're the backup running back. And then when they expect that one thing, the running in that situation can be more efficient for a backup running back. But generally, yes, the best players are going to be the ones who, in all situations, regardless of the situation, are doing what's best for the team there.
Over the last like 15 years or so, let's just say back to 2000, passing has become increasingly more efficient than rushing, and the gap between passing efficiency and rushing efficiency just gets larger and larger each year, especially according to our net expected points metric. So since the average rush technically produces a negative expected points value, I know that that's sometimes difficult for people to fully comprehend, but if you're comparing a rush to a pass, passing is just that much more efficient. Are there any positives at all to running the football or building a team around rushing production at the NFL level?
Yeah, so I don't know that I would currently build a team around rushing production, but there definitely are still positives to rushing the ball. Again, like I just mentioned, game theory is such a huge part of football, where the defense is constantly trying to predict whether the offense is going to run or pass, and they have to adjust their defense accordingly. There are still situations where I believe teams should be rushing more often than they do. That doesn't mean that they should always be rushing in that situation, but a lot of times there are third and shorts, or like when you're right at the goal line, it's more efficient to rush the ball than pass the ball. And generally, you just want to alter your strategy so that the defense doesn't really know it's coming. That being said, I do believe teams should be passing the ball much more frequently given the ability of passers nowadays. And I would love to see further trends moving towards that, as obviously has been in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that a team like Green Bay or a team, I mean, we've seen it at times with New England too, where they just have this insanely pass-heavy approach, where they'll have a game where they throw the ball 90% of the time. That one Ravens game pops into my head with the Patriots. But obviously, there are instances where teams just don't have a quarterback to be able to do that. I mean, the Jaguars probably aren't better off with Blake Bortles throwing more passes necessarily because it's Blake Bortles. That actually, I do want to touch on also with net expected points. I think one thing that it really shows, and you can elaborate on this, is the influence that turnovers have. Because oftentimes people look at box scores and they see this guy has 10 interceptions, this guy has 11 interceptions, but not all interceptions are created equal. Can you kind of just explain that very quickly, just so that the listeners can understand that to a greater detail?
Yeah, absolutely. It's with all turnovers, really. And it what gets factored in is the return as well. So if you see an interception just kind of in the middle of the field, it's going to be a net negative. You're losing the expected points that your team have, which might be anywhere from 0 to 7, and you're giving the opponent expected points on their starting field position. But if you're like on the goal line and you throw an interception in the end zone and they run it back for a touchdown, you're losing essentially 7 net expected points, and they're gaining essentially 7. So it's literally a 14-point swing, which shows up in the net expected points box score, as opposed to what you might see in the traditional box score.
So not only are yards not all created equal, but neither are turnovers.
Exactly.
So as a fantasy owner, because a lot of folks listening to this are fantasy owners who aren't necessarily digging into net expected points the way that you do, or the way that I do even throughout the season, how do you think that, you know, are there ways that they can quickly analyze this and utilize this data to be better fantasy owners?
Yeah, so I think the quickest and easiest way to do it is looking at matchup data and our team rankings, for example. So you can very quickly look at how efficient a team is on offense or defense and have a better understanding of it than looking at their yards ranks, which is what you generally see in the public, mm-hmm. is the team's yards ranking on defense. And the reason that's valuable is because that yard ranking is hugely dependent on the game situation. If a team is winning a bunch, the opposing team is going to be throwing on them much more, and their passing yards allowed should be a lot higher, because just out of sheer volume. Whereas if you're looking at net expected points, you can see how good their defense actually is at stopping or allowing the different rushing and passing in different situations.
Yeah, makes total sense. So let's shift our focus a little bit from net expected points to win probability, because this is a very, very hotly contested topic, especially on football Twitter, especially after the Super Bowl. Because I don't know if you heard, Keith, but the Falcons blew a 25-point second-half lead in the Super Bowl, and they ended up losing. So naturally, people screamed at win probability calculators, including the one that we have over at Number Fire Live, saying that, oh my God, Atlanta had a 98, 99% chance to win. All of these calculators got it wrong, not unlike what happened in the election. So with that being said, do you think that there's... So I know the answer to this deep down, but do you think that there is some sort of flaw in the way that these calculators, like the one that we have on Number Fire Live, are calculating win probability, or are people just consuming it all incorrectly?
I think it's most likely that people are consuming it incorrectly. I can't for sure say that there's not something wrong with other win probability models or with ours, but given the historical data that it's based off of, the win probability that that different sites were giving the Falcons at that time seems legitimate. So I think the highest we ever got was like 98.7% win probability when they were up, 25 in the third quarter. I saw a couple of stats after that because obviously every site that had the win probability was trying to defend the win probability. And one of them was that teams leading by 25 or more points at any time in a game were like 2,500, 4-2 in the regular season, which worked out to like a 0.2% comeback. So in that case, it was pretty accurate, although that's a little bit biased because you're looking at also more than 25 points. The other one was that since 2001, teams down between 23 and 26 with 6 to 9 minutes left in the third quarter were 0-190. So this was literally the first win in that situation, which still is a 0.5% win rate. So I think these rare situations do happen, and that's why the win probability was not 100% at the time. But it's still an extremely rare situation. The problem is we're a little bit biased because it was such a visible situation. And it's kind of similar to what went on in the national championship last year in the Villanova game. You have this really visible event, and so people start to question the legitimacy of the data, when in reality, you need to understand what probability means, and that even though it's 99% and everyone sees that as a sure thing, 1 out of 100 times, the team's still going to come back.
Yeah, I mean, the problem too is that people are only looking at this rather than looking at all of the instances where this did not happen, because if there's a blowout, if there's a 25-point second half lead, we're changing the channel. We're going to a different game. We don't care about what happens in that game because comebacks are so unlikely in those instances. But with that being said, you know, you mentioned that I think, you know, we peaked around 98.75% in favor of the Falcons in that game, which was more conservative than a lot of other sites were with the Falcons and Patriots, and the Patriots winning that game. So in circumstances like we had in the Super Bowl, are you weighing the fact that in this win probability model, are you weighing the fact that the Patriots are really, really good and that Tom Brady is Tom Brady? What kind of separates or separated Number Fire's win probability model in your eyes from the others that are out there?
Yeah, so we definitely include team strength in our model, and that's where the Patriots' ability, especially on offense, is factored into it. So that might be a little bit, although a lot of other models will try to include some component of team strength. I think the biggest thing about our model is that football is inherently a state-based game, in that you have the down, distance to go, yard line, you have the score. It's similar to actually baseball in the sense where, like, you can really define everything that's going on with a set of characteristics as a different state. And football is extremely hard to model at the end of the game, mostly because the difference in scores, the difference between being up by 3 and being up by 4 is pretty dramatic, whereas the difference between being up by 13 and 14 is not that big at the end of the game. So ours is a Markov model, which really enables you to break it down to those different states and look at how those small differences might make a dramatic difference in the actual win probability. Because if you're just doing some sort of basic regression where you're including all score differentials as equal, then you're missing like a huge part of football, which is the different, like everything goes up by 3 or 7 points as opposed to basketball where it's always 1, 2, or 3.
Yeah, makes total sense. Keith, before I let you go, I know that we haven't published our power rankings yet on the website, which will probably happen next month, but Who's the one team this year, or maybe a couple teams, that you could see shock the league similar to the Falcons a season ago?
Yeah, so there's a couple. So generally what I'm looking at here is what teams have underperformed, what teams were a lot more efficient than their record might reflect, which happens a lot in football because you have such a small sample size of games. So a couple teams that stand out to me are the Cardinals and Saints, who both finished at 7-8-1 and 7-9, but were generally pretty efficient with the ball. And the last team is the Chargers, who finished at 5-11, and we had them in the top half of our power rankings the entire year last year.
Yeah, great defense for, I always want to say San Diego, but they're not San Diego.
Oh, yeah,
anymore.
They're Los Angeles now.
Yes,
wow.
Yes. Great defense for the Chargers. I love the Chargers this year. I think they could shock a lot of people. It's a tough division, but we'll see what happens. Keith, I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about net expected points and a little bit about win probability. For anyone not following Keith on Twitter, you can at Keith Goldner. And anyone not subscribed to this podcast, do so immediately, please. Go to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, all of them. Search for the Late Round Podcast. Hit subscribe and never miss a show again. I'll talk to you guys later in the week.